From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This demonstration will continue. We will have a mass meeting tonight, and after the mass meeting, we will be demonstrating even further on tomorrow. So then this will only give us an impetus to move ahead rather than to slow down. We intend to completely eradicate Jim Crow here in Jackson, Mississippi.
40 years ago today, civil rights leader Medgar Evers was gunned down in his driveway in Jackson, Mississippi. We'll talk with his widow, Merle Evers Williams. Then the Martha Stewart case. We'll talk to a former Wall Street Journal reporter who was arrested for insider trading.
The Martha Stewart case will be a show trial, much like mine was in the early 1980s. These are high publicity cases involving very small amounts of money intended to take advantage of the shock value.
And blacklisted screenwriter Norma Barzman will join us in the studio to talk about Hollywood during the McCarthy era.
I was a blacklisted screenwriter who lived through HUAC and McCarthyism and exile, and I can tell you that today is far more dangerous than then.
The Red and the Blacklist, the intimate memoir of a Hollywood expatriate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli army has been ordered to, quote, completely wipe out members of Hamas, this according to Israel Public Radio. The order was given after Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz met with his generals. It said everyone, quote, from the lowliest member to Sheikh Ahmad Yassin is a legitimate target. This comes a day after 26 Israelis and Palestinians were killed in one of the bloodiest days in the region in years. A Palestinian suicide bomber dressed as an Orthodox Jew boarded a rush hour bus in Jerusalem and detonated a bomb, killing 16. More than 100 people were injured. Israel soon launched the first of three air attacks on Gaza, killing a pair of Hamas members, including a senior commander, Tito Masoud. Five Palestinians who were nearby were also killed. Two more Palestinians died in later Israeli missile attacks. The deadly suicide bombing came just one day after Israel attempted to assassinate Dr. Abdelaziz Rantisi, top political leader and spokesperson for Hamas. Rantisi was injured. At least two others were killed. According to the Guardian of London, there is an uncommon consensus ranging from the Israeli far right to the Palestinian leadership that the assassination attempt on Rantisi is bound up in Sharon's reluctance to start down the Bush administration's so-called roadmap to peace. Foreign diplomats and Israeli newspapers are asking of the assassination attempt, why now? Just last week, President Bush met with Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers in a historic peace conference in Jordan. Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen pledged to exert full efforts in ending the Intifada. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said the establishment of a democratic Palestinian state is in Israel's interests and pledged to dismantle some, quote, unauthorized outposts. 22 Palestinians and 21 Israelis have been killed since the Aqaba summit last week. Meanwhile, in Washington, Democratic supporters of Israel assailed President Bush for criticizing Israeli military attacks on Palestinians. This, according to the New York Times, among the Democratic critics were Congressmember Robert Wexler of Florida and Tom Lantos of California. Bush had criticized Israel's attempted assassination of Abdelaziz Rantisi, the top political leader of Hamas. The influential pro-Israel lobbying group, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, known as AIPAC, also issued a rare criticism of Bush. In Iraq, 4,000 U.S. forces launched the military's largest operation since Baghdad fell 2 months ago. The troops swept through areas north of Baghdad, searching for loyalists to Saddam Hussein's regime. Three Iraqis were killed. 390 are being detained, including some as young as 13 years old. This according to the Washington Post. It is unclear how many thousands of Iraqis were being held even before the latest 390. 10 U.S. troops were also injured in the operation. The New York Times reporting the Pentagon's refusing to tell the public how many times U.S. forces have been attacked by Iraqis over the past 6 weeks in Iraq. In other Iraq news, U.S. military authorities are investigating the death of a 52-year-old Iraqi man who died in an American detention facility near Nasiriyah. Washington Post reports the criminal investigation is the first involving the death of a prisoner in U.S. custody in Iraq. The detainee, whose name was not given, died on Friday. He'd been in military custody since May 3rd. The Guardian of London is reporting that the U.S. is turning up the heat on countries in the Balkans and Eastern Europe to secure war crimes immunity deals for Americans and exemptions from the year-old International Criminal Court. The U.S. administration is threatening to cut off tens of millions of dollars in aid to countries in the Balkans, including the states of the former Yugoslavia, unless they agree to U.S. demands. Last week, Bosnia signed the exemption deal as it was threatened with the loss of $73 million in aid. Former Yugoslavia is particularly central to the U.S. command to exempt Americans from the scope of the International Criminal Court because there are U.S. troops still stationed in Bosnia and Kosovo. Pentagon advisor Richard Perle said yesterday the U.S. should be prepared to unilaterally and preemptively attack North Korea to destroy its nuclear facilities. Perle added, "We should always be prepared to go it alone if necessary." He also suggested North Korea may attempt to help al-Qaeda. He said, quote, "I think we must assume that if they had a nuclear weapon and if al-Qaeda wished to purchase a nuclear weapon, it's a deal that could be done." Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld yesterday claimed Iran is working on developing a nuclear bomb. Rumsfeld's comments appear to be aimed at exerting pressure on Tehran and the UN's Nuclear Monitoring Agency, which meets next week in Vienna to decide how to respond to Iran's failure to honor nuclear safeguards. Congressional Republicans yesterday rejected Democrats' demands for a full-blown probe into whether the Bush administration manipulated pre-war intelligence on Iraq's weapons programs. Republicans promised the intelligence would be reviewed only in closed-door hearings. Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware, the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, said the Bush administration, quote, took a truth and they embellished it. He said, "What I'm accusing them of doing is hyping it. They created a false sense of urgency." Biden went on to say the administration presented, quote, "a questionable and hard to sustain tie with terrorist organizations and exaggerated Iraq's capacity to use illegal weapons against U.S. troops." He said the administration also exaggerated how close the Iraqis were to building nuclear weapons. And in Canada, nearly two dozen gay and lesbian couples yesterday applied for marriage licenses. Tuesday court ruling led to Canada's first legal same-sex wedding this week.
By his home, hidden by the night, as ever stepped out from his car into the rifle sight. He slowly squeezed the trigger, the bullet left his side. It struck the heart of every man when Evers fell and died. Too many martyrs and too many dead. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. They laid him in his grave while the bugle sounded clear. They laid him in his grave while the victory was near. While we waited for the future, for freedom through the land, the country gained a killer and the country lost a man. Too many martyrs and too many dead. Too many lies, too many empty words were said. Too many times for too many angry men.
The Ballad of Medgar Evers, Phil Oakes. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to our listeners and viewers. It was 40 years ago today that a gunshot in the night took the life of Medgar Evers, the civil rights leader. His assassination concluded a seminal day in the civil rights movement. Earlier that day, Alabama segregationist Governor George Wallace had stood on the steps of the state's all-white university and tried to block the admission of two black students. That night, President Kennedy delivered an impassioned speech defending the federal government's intervention on behalf of the students. Kennedy spoke of a moral crisis facing the nation.
With Evers' death, the movement lost one of its most inspired leaders. He became an NAACP leader in 1954 after the all-white University of Mississippi rejected his law school application. Through the NAACP, Evers fought to increase black voter registration, led business boycotts, and brought attention to the murders and lynchings like the slaying of black teenager Emmett Till. This is Medgar Evers speaking shortly before he was killed 40 years ago today.
This demonstration will continue. We will have a mass meeting tonight, and after the mass meeting, we will be demonstrating even further on tomorrow. So then this will only give us an impetus to move ahead rather than to slow down. We intend to completely eradicate Jim Crow here in Jackson, Mississippi.
Medgar Evers, killed June 12th, 1963, in his driveway. Merle Evers Williams now joins us on the line. She is the widow of Medgar Evers. It was a day, of course, you have described many times, but would you mind for a moment, as we welcome you to Democracy Now!, to go back to that time and tell us what happened at your house?
Basically, you have done a very good job of setting the scene for that particular day. Of course, Medgar was the sole spokesperson and leader in the state of Mississippi on behalf of his people and the NAACP. That automatically put him at the top of the list of people to be eliminated and, of course, murdered. That was publicly known, but it was something that did not keep Medgar from doing what he believed in, even though he knew that he would probably have to give his life. That day was one where there was a lot of excitement in the air. There were many young people, college students from Tougaloo College, and others who had been put in what we called our concentration camp then. That concentration camp as such was the Mississippi Fairgrounds in Jackson, Mississippi. Medgar had been working around the clock for weeks with the boycotts and the meetings that had been held. And when he left home that morning, he spoke to us, myself and our children, in terms of how tired he was. But he said he loved us, and he went off to work. He did something quite unusual. He called back two or three times that day and reaffirmed how much he loved us. It was almost as though he had a premonition. The last time we spoke, he told me to be sure to allow the children to stay up to hear President Kennedy's speech, and that he loved us and he would see us that night. The children were up. I was across our bed with our three-year-old child. The other two were sitting on the floor. They heard their dad's car, and they said, "Mommy, Mommy, there's Daddy." You know, after 40 years, it's still a little difficult to deal with that, even though I've told the story before. But he got out of the car, and we heard this blast. The children fell to the floor, as Medgar had taught them to do. And as I got up off of the bed, they pulled their little brother down on the floor and began to crawl to the bathroom, because they had decided, along with their daddy, that the bathroom inside of the tub would be the safest place in the house for them to go. I rushed to the front door, turned on the light, and I knew exactly what I was going to see, and that was Metka's body. He had pulled himself around my car because the force of that hunting rifle, the bullet, had pushed him forward, and he was able to crawl to the steps with his keys in his hand. Pandemonium broke out. I began to scream. The children ran out of the door crying, "Daddy, Daddy, get up, Daddy, get up, Daddy." Neighbors began to rush out of the house. Shortly thereafter, police cars arrived. A Medgar was placed on a mattress and taken to one of the hospitals in Jackson, where he was denied admission until they found out who he was. One of the regrets that I still have some 40 years later is that well-meaning friends and neighbors held me back physically and would not allow me to go to the hospital with him. Medgar and I had been through all of this together, and I certainly wanted to be by his side when he took his last breath, but alas, that was not to be. So today, some 40 years later, I still work very hard to see that he is remembered, that young people, a generation of people who were not born at that time, recognize who he was, that he received, that he will receive the credit for the work that he did, because he certainly did not want credit for what he was doing when he was alive, but I believe he deserves it.
Merle.
Yes.
Evers. Merle Evers is the Evers Williams is the widow of civil rights leader Medgar Evers, also served as chair of the NAACP herself. Juan?
Well, it took 30 years for some measure of justice to occur in this case when finally Byron Della Beckwith was convicted of your husband's murder. Could you talk about your quest to achieve justice in this case? And
yes, of course. I had made a promise to Medgar, and that was within the last week or two of his life. As we held each other and said, we know it's going to happen, we just don't know when, but it will be soon. And I told him, if anything happened to him, that I would see to it, if I were alive, that justice would be served. That was a promise I made to him. There were three trials. Of course, the first two were trials that ended with hung jurors. However, it was a chance to pay in-depth attention to Beckwith. He loved to brag about his hatred and his vision of eradicating blacks and Jews from America. And I knew within my heart that at some point he would boast himself into admitting that he had pulled that trigger. I would return back to Mississippi 3 or 4 times a year. That was after we moved, a year after Metka's death. People began to tell me I was making a nuisance of myself because I would not let go of this dream that I had of initially vengeance, but just to see that justice was done. And I would inquire where the man was, what he was doing. As a result of that, sometime later, many years later, a young reporter with one of the newspapers in Mississippi called me and said, I understand over the years you've been looking for information that could open a third trial and hopefully get a conviction. And I said, yes. He said, I have something for you. Are you interested? So, you know, the lesson there is perseverance. If you believe in something, if you have a mission in life, and that was one of my missions, just keep going, regardless of what people say to you. And it turned out that that was just enough to get the case reopened. And, of course, we know what happened at the end. There was a guilty verdict that was rendered. And I must tell you that my children and I said that when that verdict of guilty was issued, we felt all of the ghosts as such, all of the ill feelings, all of the demons just escaped from our body. We became free for the first time, I think, for them in their lives and for me in my young adult life. And as was said by a former governor of the state of Mississippi a couple of nights ago, Mississippi became free, and America took a step further toward freedom. One of the interesting things that has happened, though, as a result of that, is that there have been 18 additional civil rights cases that have been reopened and prosecuted, and some guilty decisions have been rendered. So I feel that perhaps through my perseverance with Metcalf's case, that many others have been settled as a result of that. And even though people say, you know, you need to leave the past alone, that happened then, we are doing much better now, there is a cleansing that needs to be done in America. And I think we're well on our way toward that.
Yet when you see, I've had a chance to visit Jackson and in recent times, and clearly there a lot remains to be done in terms of achieving full equality for the African American community there in Mississippi. And your thoughts in terms, well, there's been progress. There's still a Trent Lott as the senator in Mississippi. There are still enormous problems even at the national level with how African Americans and other people of color are treated in the country.
I still think we have major problems in America in that arena, that many people choose to deny that they exist. Having been born, reared, educated in the state of Mississippi, and I still call it home because it is, I realize how far we have come over this period of 40 years. Just recently, I was invited by the Mississippi State Legislature, where both houses presented accommodation regarding Metcalf's life and his work. Just 2 days ago, I was in Metcalf's hometown of Decatur in the county of Newton, and for the first time, that town and county had a celebration of Metcalf's life that brought many people together who had not been together. And I can list a number of things where I can see progress, but I am not so foolish as to close my eyes to inequities that still exist in the state of Mississippi. But truly, if we look around America, we still find some of the same problems that we addressed before. It's one thing about Mississippians, whether it's Trent Lott or someone else, it may slip, but they usually say what they mean. And it makes it much easier to deal with those opinions and the actions that people take. It is my hope, though, that 40 years later, we will see people become more aware of the very subtle types of racism that we have, that people will become more aware of the importance that they use the vote that so many people gave their lives for, that it is not a simple thing that my one vote does not count, because that does not speak to the truth. Had I not received one vote extra when I was elected to the board as chairman of the NAACP, I would not have held that position and not been able to work with others to save that organization. There are just critical things that need to be done, and my mission at this point is to heighten the awareness of Metcalf and others, particularly in the state of Mississippi, the unsung heroes who paid a dear price to help us to get to where we are. So as a result of that, a few of us have organized a struggling nonprofit organization, the Medgar Evers Institute, with the focus being on working with young people, developing leaders, using education as a tool, and speaking to something that a lot of people feel that we shouldn't, and that's reconciliation. And it does not necessarily mean reconciliation just between races, but that's a human condition that we are interested in. So that's where we are today. I continue to tell people to open their eyes and see the subtleties of racism and segregation. And once again, I'm told you're living in the past, but I'm not. It's very much here in the present. And if we take the time, we will find that some of those gains that we have made have already slipped away from us. We're still heavily debating affirmative action. Many people are refusing to see the progress that was made and that's still being made for minorities. And I will put, at this time, women in that category, too. Some people in corporate America have been brave enough to speak out and say that they have benefited as an entity from these kinds of things. Our national leadership needs to be shaken up a little bit in terms of where they are putting emphasis in that arena. And I'm just hoping for the best. Someone said to me, where are you going to be at the 50th anniversary? I don't know whether I'll be around or not, but if I am, I hope I'm still fighting for the things that Medgar fought for, because even 10 years hence, I believe we will need to do that.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Merle Evers-Williams, for joining us. Merle Evers-Williams, widow of civil rights leader Medgar Evers, she herself served as chair of the NAACP. She was also the first African-American woman to be appointed to the Los Angeles Board of Public Works and has written two books, one for Us the Living and her autobiography, Watch Me Fly, What I Learned on the Way to Becoming the Woman I Was Meant to Be. Our break is Nina Simone's first protest song, prompted by the murder of Medgar Evers 40 years ago today. The song is Mississippi Goddamn.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Lurleen Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama has got me so upset, and Memphis has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Hound dogs on my trail.
Nina Simone, Mississippi Goddamn, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the government pursues Martha Stewart for avoiding $50,000 in losses, the press has begun to question why it has yet to indict former Enron CEO Ken Lay and former WorldCom CEO Bernard Ebbers. Both men are alleged to have made millions in profits from fraudulent schemes and caused significant losses to millions of investors. On Tuesday, the founder of ImClone Systems, Sam Waxel, was sentenced to 7 years in the stock trading scandal that ensnared his friend Martha Stewart. A federal judge handed down the sentence Tuesday. Waxel was also ordered to pay nearly $4.3 million in fines and back taxes. Stewart was a longtime friend of Waxel. She's accused by federal prosecutors of unloading her ImClone stock when she heard the Waxels were quietly selling their stocks. Also Tuesday, Martha Stewart appeared at the FBI's Manhattan headquarters for a quiet mugshot and fingerprinting session. We're joined on the phone right now by Foster Winans. He's the former Wall Street Journal reporter who was convicted of insider trading for leaking advance word of his columns to a broker, served 9 months in prison in 1988, and wrote a book about his experiences called Trading Secrets, Seduction and Scandal at the Wall Street Journal. Juan?
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us, Foster Winans.
Thank you.
Well, as someone experienced in these matters, could you give us your take on how the media and prosecutors are dealing with some of these corruption scandals?
Well, I think in a totalitarian regime, they call them show trials. These are sort of publicity stunts, which does not take away from the fact that Martha Stewart and Sam Waxall were arrogant and full of themselves and should definitely be punished. But the question that I ask is does our government have so much money and resources that they can prosecute everybody who goes through a stop sign? You mentioned at the beginning of your introduction the heads of MCI and Enron and what happened with them. And that's kind of my reaction is why are we spending all this time and energy on a couple of scofflaws when there are, you know, all these people out there who basically stole everyone's retirement? The fraud on Wall Street was racketeering. There's no leadership on this issue. The Justice Department is silent.
Can you remind listeners what happened to you, you were picked up, how you were found out, what you did?
Yeah. In 1983, I was a relatively young, fairly modestly paid columnist for the Wall Street Journal, living in Manhattan, and I told a stockbroker what was going to be in my stock market column the next day. And he tried to take advantage of the fact that articles about stocks appearing in the journal would cause them to rise or fall, depending on whether the article suggested a positive or a negative future for the stock. And I was paid $30,000. He made about $700,000. The scheme went on for about 3 months. The FCC found out about it. I was prosecuted by then U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani. I admitted what I did. I denied that it was a crime. We went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court didn't agree with me, and I served 9 months in Danbury Federal Prison Camp in Connecticut, which is where Martha Stewart will do her time, assuming that she's convicted.
Do you have thoughts about how white-collar criminals should serve time, or if they should?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Have thoughts about white-collar criminals serving time?
Oh, yes, I definitely do. Let's say someone like a Ken Lay or somebody like that, I don't think, first of all, that, of course, the criminal justice system is broken, and there are an awful lot of people who shouldn't be in jail. So beginning on that premise, people who commit large economic crimes or economic crimes like this, I would put them into very visible community service situations. Say Sam Waxall, maybe have him wear an orange jumpsuit that says, I trashed my company and all I got was this lousy jumpsuit, and put him to work in a cancer ward emptying bedpans for 5 years, or take a Wall Street crook and put him in an orange jumpsuit that says, I stole your retirement, and make him empty waste baskets on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange so that everybody can see every day what happens when you screw up. That what we have, the system we have now is we send these people away, we wash our hands of them, the problem's been solved, everybody's been locked up, and nothing could be further from the truth. What most white-collar criminals do in jail is complain about getting caught and worry about somebody finding where they hid in the loot.
That some people might question that, whether we do put these people away or whether there's the occasional show trial, as you say, but so many escape. I could just think in the last few decades, in the late 60s, the big bank financing HUD scandals. Then we had in the 80s, the leveraged, the Milken and the Boesky and the leveraged buyout scandals, and then the savings and loan scandal. And now we have the latest of the telecom and energy and other scandals. And, of course, back again to the financial houses, the brokerages. It seems that the the scandals are periodic on Wall Street of corruption and theft, and just putting people in jumpsuits doesn't seem to me like it's going to do much to deter people who obviously feel that whenever they can grab the money, they will.
Well, that is definitely not a solution. Is not putting people in jail or jumpsuits or anything like that. I mean, that's the townspeople going out to the sheriff and saying, "Hey, they robbed the bank. Why didn't you? You know, it's a little late. It's a little late to complain to the sheriff about the bank being robbed." But my solution is that the whole corporate governance structure needs to change. You know, this whole business of being a director of a large public company is a scam. It's if I'm on the board of General Motors, I can make a lot of money by being on the boards of other companies, and I get free stock. And what I'm doing is I'm lending my credibility to another company so they can go out and raise money, and God help the investors of the other company if it's not a real deal. The solution is that, and it's not. I don't believe in government regulation of everything, but I think the answer is that someone's got to take leadership and talk about ethics in business, ethics in society, to create an atmosphere in which that kind of behavior, the kind of behavior we just went through, is unacceptable. Having said that, when the markets are going up and there's lots going on, people are going to get really greedy. And during the late market bubble, I was talking to Ron Insana, who's one of the anchors of CNBC, and I said, you know, don't you guys feel that you bear a responsibility because you promoted all these analysts promoting all these stocks and gave all these people credibility? And he said, you know, whenever we tried to do a story that said, hey, folks, these stocks are overpriced, we got hate mail. So, you know, you have to, I mean, it's not a simple solution.
We're talking to Foster Winans, former Wall Street Journal reporter, convicted of insider trading. We're also joined on the line by Russell McIver. He is editor of the Washington, D.C.-based Corporate Crime Reporter. Russell, first want to get your response to the very high-profile indictment of Martha Stewart.
Good morning, Amy. Juan Foster.
Good morning, Russell.
Well, first of all, I interviewed Foster last week for Corporate Crime Reporter, and I think if Martha had done what Foster did, she wouldn't be in the trouble she's in now. Because when Foster got caught, he went to the SEC, he took his checkbooks, he took his telephone records, and he said to federal prosecutors, hey, I did this. And he threw himself on the mercy of the system. He admitted it. After committing the crime, he said, look, I did this. Now, he didn't believe it was a crime, but he admitted what he did. If you look at the indictment against Martha Stewart, which is posted on our website, and I urge people to go to it and read it. It's www.corporatecrimereporter.com and click on Martha Stewart indictment. And 41 pages, it's an interesting read. She didn't do what Foster did, according to the government. She went in and concocted a story that said, hey, I was going to sell this when it went below 60. And she lied to the government. Now, if you read William Safire in the New York Times today, he would have us believe that the U.S. attorney abused his prosecutorial discretion by bringing this case. And he would have us believe that he's trying to make a name for himself by bringing this case, as Giuliani made a name for himself by bringing the case against Winans. Now, that might be true. But, I mean, that's the nature of prosecuting high-profile white-collar crime cases. And I don't think the prosecutors should not bring these cases because they're celebrities or because they're corporate executives or because they're presidents of the United States or because, you know, they're Sammy Sosa. You should look at the case, and if something wrong has happened and your job is to enforce the law, you should enforce the law. So I also think it's interesting, though, that the white-collar criminals who are coming out are in the forefront of the decriminalization movement. So, you know, Angela Davis can write a book saying we should empty the prisons of nonviolent criminals, which apparently she has just done, and who's going to listen to that? But when Foster Winans and others who are out of prison say, hey, the criminal justice system is messed up, people are going to listen. So, I would agree with Foster on many of the points that he's making. I do believe in alternative sentencing across the board. So, you know, if someone's caught with an ounce of marijuana and they end up in jail for 10 years, let's talk about that, too. Let's not just focus on, just because for once in a long time, federal prosecutors are focusing on this this wave of white-collar crime, and they are focusing on it. I'm going to challenge Foster when he says the Justice Department is silent on the Enron crimes. They have a huge task force down in Houston, and Sharon Watkins, who was the Time Person of the Year, the whistleblower at Enron, says she believes that upward of 20 or 30 Enron executives are going to jail. And, you know, few who look at that prosecutorial task force can dispute that, and perhaps even Ken Lay. You know, when it comes to putting it to white-collar and corporate criminals, all of a sudden we're hearing, hey, they don't belong in jail. So let's get rid of the double standard. Let's either say, let's empty the prisons of nonviolent criminals and put them to work where, you know, either they can be shamed and do good work at the same time or some kind of alternative sentencing. But let's get rid of the double standard.
I would,
but Russell, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the firms like Merrill Lynch and Solomon Smith Barney and these others, Attorney General Spitzer made a lot of noise about going after them, and to my sense, my view, took a dive at the end and basically let them off with a few hundred million in fines apiece.
They absolutely took a dive. Foster and I agree on this. Spitzer took a dive, and Spitzer admits it. Spitzer says, look, I'm not going to put these firms out of business. I want to be governor of New York. He said it at the press conference. I asked him at the press conference at the SEC, why is no one going to jail here? And he said, look, if we force these companies to admit wrongdoing, if we put some people in jail here, you know, these companies could go out of business. And we're not going to put Wall Street out of business. And Foster agrees with that.
I gave a talk at a white collar crime conference about 2 months ago, and what I believe is going to happen is a little less obvious than putting Wall Street people in jail, and that is that there will be a tremendous number of civil lawsuits. The investigators who worked on that settlement, the one that you referred to with Elliot Spitzer, told me that we left a paper trail 6 lanes wide for civil litigators to come along. I would not be surprised to see a racketeering case brought against the 10 families of Wall Street, you know, kind of like the 5 families of New York. And I think that you will see the landscape change dramatically. And as far as Martha Stewart and those cases are concerned, I do believe that there should be prosecution. My argument is these cases should have been settled 6 months or a year ago. And you know, fine them and give them penalties and move on to the big fish, the ones that really stole everybody's money.
Right, but Foster, we don't know why that didn't happen. It could be because she didn't do what you did.
It could be that she
was fighting them from the beginning and making up stories from the beginning.
Let me make clear that my argument is that there's no moral leadership on this issue in this nation. There is no person and no organization that's standing out there and saying our entire financial system is broken and somebody has to stand up and say things like the CEO cannot also be the chairman of a company, which is a conflict of interest, and somebody needs to stand up and say a lot of people on Wall Street need to find something else to do for a living while we find people who have ethics and morals that agree with the rest of us.
Well, the problem is, Foster, that when it comes to street crimes, we talk about law and order. When it comes to corporate and white-collar crimes, all of a sudden we're talking about ethics and morals. And that's because there's this huge business in this country, this consultancy business, where people go around and they get paid big bucks to advise corporations on ethics programs and keeping people in line and that stuff. And it's all geared at sentencing so that, you know, the sentencing guidelines say that you have to have this carrot and stick approach and so forth and so on. But when it comes to just street criminals, no one talks about ethics and morals. It talks about you violate the law, you go to jail. So I say let's keep the white collar corporate wrongdoing in the legal arena.
Right.
If they commit a crime, then they should be in the criminal justice system.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Foster Winans, former Wall Street Journal reporter, convicted of insider trading, now runs a nonprofit Writers Center in Pennsylvania. You can go to his website at www.fosterwinans.com. And Russell McIver, corporate crime reporter in Washington. Your website, Russell?
www.corporatecrimereporter.com and read the Martha Stewart indictment.
And that's where you can read that indictment. When we come back, The Red and the Blacklist, the intimate memoir of a Hollywood expatriate. Stay with us.
As Yes, I raise my hand to broadcast my objection to latest triumph draws the final straw. Who died and lifted you up to perfection? And what silenced me is written into law. I can't believe where circumstances throw me, and I turn my head away. If I look, I'm not sure that I could face you. Not again, not today, not today. If hatred makes a play on me tomorrow, and forgiveness take a backseat to revenge, there's a hurt down deep that has not been corrected. There's a voice in me that says you will not win. And if I
The Final Straw, R.E.M. here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Even a hint of the blacklist must never again be tolerated in this nation. That was part of the text of a memo sent by the Screen Actors Guild to Hollywood filmmakers in March as the U.S. prepared to invade Iraq. By then, some of Hollywood's biggest names were already coming under intense criticism for their anti-war views. Some of those targeted were Michael Moore, Susan Sarandon, Rob Lowe, Martin Sheen, Jim Robbins.
Well, today we're going to go back 50 years to Hollywood during the McCarthy era to speak with a blacklisted screenwriter. Her name is Norma Barsman. She has just published a memoir of the era called The Red and the Blacklist. In 1948, she and her husband, screenwriter Ben Barsman, were identified as communists. They were forced to flee Hollywood and the country. They went into exile in Europe. While blacklisted, Norma Barsman worked on numerous films and wrote numerous screenplays, but her name often did not appear in the credits. The Writers Guild of America just restored her credit for Never Say Goodbye, Luxury Girls. She's still battling for credit on the classic film The Locket and joins us in the studio today. Welcome to Democracy Now!
I'm so happy to be here, Amy. I'm a fan of yours.
It's a great to have you here. In fact, I saw you. You reminded me in Santa Fe, New Mexico, for the 50th anniversary of the release of the blacklisted film, Salt of the Earth.
That was so exciting to see it commemorated in that way. And if you remember, Victor Novasky and I were on a panel. And we're going to be on a panel alone together on Monday night at the New School, 7 o'clock.
Here in New York City.
Yes, talking about the blacklist.
Well, Norma Barsman, can you read an excerpt, the beginning of your book, The Red and the Blacklist?
All right, this is before the titles, as though it were before the screenplay. Monday, March 22nd, 1999, the day after the Oscars, the phone rang. It was Sophia. What other Sophia was there? She said, Norma, I saw you on television and you were beautiful. I said, Sophia, I saw you on television and you were beautiful. Sophia Loren became our close friend in 1960 in Madrid when my husband, Ben Barsman, was writing El Cid straight for the screen. Laughing melodiously, Sophia said, I'm calling because you did a wonderful job. Only about a third of the audience stood and applauded Kazan. In less than 5 weeks, those of us blacklisted writers who were still alive had organized a protest against the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences, granting a lifetime award to informer Ilya Kazan. We opposed the award because during the frenzy of Cold War McCarthyism, Kazan, a distinguished New York theater director, in order to continue to work in films, became a star witness for the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, and named as communists some of his closest friends. To most of the blacklisted, his lifetime achievements were not only his films, for which he had already received two Oscars, Gentleman's Agreement and On the Waterfront, but also the destruction of lives. That did seem his achievement. I had pity for the old man, Sophia went on, but I sat quietly and did not applaud. Next to me, Benigni. In front of me, Spielberg, Tom Hanks, Geffen, Sherry Lansing, all sitting. I turn around, in back of me, every row down. At home later, I looked at the tape. A small group led by Charlton Heston was standing as if they were everyone in the audience, applauding loudly. But I was there. What was shown on TV was not what I saw or heard. Most people were seated. Applause was slight. You know, Norma, I'm not political, but this, how could the Academy do it? I do not understand. I didn't understand either. I'm still trying to understand what began on my 21st birthday, September 15th, 1941, the day I arrived in Hollywood. Or did it really begin 1 year later with the cross between a boy meets girl screwball comedy and a fighting love story?
And so begins Norma Barsman's book, The Red and the Blacklist, the intimate memoir of a Hollywood expatriate. I remember in Democracy Now! That year when we covered this protest you had in front of the Academy Awards.
Yeah, I'm proud of that, and I'm also proud of the fact that I was able to convince the Academy, who felt pretty awful about having done it, that they should do an exhibition of the Blacklist, which I don't know if you remember, Amy, but first it was in the Academy in Hollywood, and then it moved to Santa Fe and to their museum. And I think it's very important. It really needs to tour the country. No other cities have asked for it, but I think it's a wonderful thing for the young to see this exhibition that the Academy really did very well on. Larry St. Clair was the curator, and it explains terribly well to the young. There were busloads of young who came down to see it.
Did you ever get a response from Elia Kazan? And what was the whole debate that erupted then? Talk about what it meant to be someone who went before HUAC. Talk about the pressures you faced in Hollywood.
You know, there's a great difference between, I'm not forgiving any of the informers, but there's a great difference between them. Kazan was the one informer who was in a position not to inform. He had not only a lot of money and success and could go on being a theater director without any problem, so that he could have stood up to the committee. But someone like Eddie Dimitrik, I'm not saying that he shouldn't have. Eddie Dimitrik did go to jail for 6 months. And when he came out, he saw that he couldn't work. And he was a guy who had started out in Hollywood as an errand boy, then learned to edit. It was really all he could do was edit and direct. And if he couldn't work in Hollywood, he had a new baby. I'm not excusing him. I'm just saying that, that there is a difference between informers. And I want to just take Eddie Dimitrik for a moment. Before he informed, he came to my husband 1 year after he was blacklisted. The blacklist really started in November 47 with the Waldorf Accords. And Eddie Dimitrik had not worked in a year. It was 1948, November, and my husband was still working. He was writing a Lana Turner film at MGM. Eddie came in with a book under his arm, Christ in Concrete, a really great American proletarian novel, maybe the only one. And he said, Ben, you've got to do a screenplay on this. And Ben said, I can't. You see, I'm in the middle of this picture for Dorie Sherry. And Eddie said, you owe it to me. Do it nights and weekends. And Ben looked at me and said, will I do it nights and weekends? And I said, yes, you will, because it's a really great project, and we'll break the blacklist for three blacklisted people to go to London and do a film there that should really be done in New York, on the east side of New York, because they had to build New York in London. Sam Wanamaker was blacklisted. He was the star, and it's an Oscar performance. Eddie Dimitrik did really his greatest work, Ben's screenplay, marvelous. and it's just come out DVD, and they sent for me to do the backstory.
How extensive was the blacklist and the purges? How many people do you estimate were affected?
Well, there were over 400, really. When I came out to Hollywood and saw the progressive community at that night at Chapayev, they had rented a fireman's hall to project it because you couldn't put it into a movie theater. I saw the stars who were there, who were not necessarily, I'm not saying they were all communists, but I saw Danny Kaye and Gene Kelly and Betsy Blair and Edward G. Robinson. You know, I was 21, and that it was very glamorous. And then, of course, about over 400, I know you asked how many, marvelous people whom I came to know. That Hollywood progressive community was something so extraordinary, I think, in world history, the way they worked together, the way the guilds and unions were organized in Hollywood, which is one reason, maybe the basic reason, why the Hollywood Ten were targeted and went to jail, because they were the leaders in the guilds and unions. And we really led the country in the Roosevelt period in progressive, I mean, legislation, social legislation. Everything they're trying to take away now was done in that period. And we were very instrumental in getting it done. And the only reason to answer your question about we were so few, but we 400 or 500, and we had the influence of thousands. It was wonderful.
We're going to continue this conversation on Monday, and I'm glad you're still in town because you'll be at the event at the New School on Monday night. So that we could talk about the individuals and what it meant to stand up. But right now, just as we wrap up, the comparison between then and now specifically in the kinds of pressures that are faced.
Well, of course, there is the blacklist that you talked about, and you didn't mention Sean Penn, and you didn't mention the CBS executive producer who was fired. He was the producer of the miniseries When Hitler Was Young, and he had done splendid work, but all he said was, the atmosphere of fear in the United States is very similar to the atmosphere of fear in Germany just before the Third Reich. And he got fired for it. Now, it would have been sufficient for CBS to say the views of the producer are not the views of CBS. That would have been sufficient. But I think firing him is to put the fear of the Lord into all of us. This is how it's working now.
Norma Barsman, thank you for part one, part two on Monday. Her book is The Red and the Blacklist, the intimate memoir of a Hollywood expatriate. And that does it for the program. Juan will be here tomorrow. I'm headed out to Olympia, Washington, to Evergreen State College to give the commencement address. It will be a very special day because the class will be remembering Rachel Corrie. She should have been graduating tomorrow as well. She was killed by an Israeli military bulldozer in the Gaza Strip in the occupied territories. And most importantly, her family will be there to receive her degree. If you want to hear that event, you can go to our website tomorrow, Eastern Standard Time. It's 4 out in Washington. It'll be 1 in the afternoon, and you can hear the whole commencement. That's democracynow.org, www.democracynow.org. If you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, and Jacaren, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nogar, Elizabeth Press, Noah Rival, Vilpot Suris, Mike DeFilippo, Rich Kim, our engineers. Special thanks to Andrew Beckman and Jeannie Austin. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.